Hachette Audio presents The Innocent, written by David Baldacci, read by Ron McLarty with Orla Cassidy. Chapter 1. Will Roby had closely observed every one of the passengers on the short flight from Dublin to Edinburgh, and confidently deduced that 16 were returning Scots and 53 were tourists. Roby was neither a Scot nor a tourist. The flight took 47 minutes to cross first the Irish Sea and then a large swath of Scotland. The cab ride in from the airport took 15 more minutes of his life. He was not staying at the Balmoral Hotel or the Scotsman or any of the other illustrious accommodations in the ancient city. He had one room on the third floor of a dirty-faced building that was a 9-minute uphill walk to the city center. He got his key and paid in cash for one night. He carried his small bag up to the room and sat on the bed. It squeaked under his weight and sank nearly 3 inches. Squeaking and sinking were what one got for so low a price. Roby was an inch over 6 feet and a rock-solid 180 pounds. He possessed a compact musculature that relied more on quickness and endurance than sheer strength. His nose had been broken once due to a mistake he had made. He had never had it reset because he'd never wanted to forget the mistake. One of his back teeth was false. That had come with the broken nose. His hair was naturally dark, and he had a lot of it. But Roby preferred to keep it about a half inch longer than a marine buzz cut. His facial features were sharply defined, but he made them mostly forgettable by almost never making eye contact with anyone. He had tats on one arm and also on his back. One tattoo was of a large tooth from a great white. The other was a red slash that looked like lightning on fire. They effectively covered up old scars that had never healed properly, and each held some significance for him. The damaged skin had proven a challenge for the tattoo artist working on Roby, but the end result had been satisfactory. Roby was 39 years old and would turn 40 the following day. He had not come to Scotland to celebrate this personal milestone. He had come here to work. Of the 365 days in a year, he was working or traveling to do his job on about half of them. Roby surveyed the room. It was small, adequate, unadorned, strategically located. He did not require much. His possessions were few, and his wants fewer still. He rose and went to the window, pressed his face to the cool glass. The sky was gloomy. It was often that way in Scotland. A full day of sun in Edinburgh was routinely greeted with both gratitude and astonishment by his citizens. Far to his left stood Holyrood Palace, the Queen's official residence in Scotland. He could not see it from here. Far to his right was Edinburgh Castle. He could not see that battered old edifice either, but knew exactly where it was. He checked his watch. A full 8 hours to go. Hours later, his internal clock woke him. He left his room and walked up toward Prince's Street. He passed the majestic Balmoral Hotel that anchored the city center. He ordered a light meal and had tap water to drink, ignoring the large selection of stouts offered on the board over the bar. As he ate, he spent some time gazing at a street performer, juggling butcher knives atop a unicycle, while regaling the crowd with funny stories, delivered with an embellished Scottish brogue. Then there was the fellow outfitted as the Invisible Man, taking pictures with passers-by for £2 each. After his meal, he walked toward Edinburgh Castle. He could see it in the distance as he ambled along. It was big, imposing, and had never once been taken by force, only stealth. He climbed to the top of the castle, peering over the gloom of the Scottish capital. He ran his hand along cannon that would never fire another shot. He turned to his left and took in the full breadth of the sea that had made Edinburgh such an important port centuries ago, as vessels came and went, disgorging freight and picking up fresh cargo. He stretched tight limbs, felt a creak, and then a pop in his left shoulder. 40. Tomorrow. But first, he had to make it to tomorrow. He checked his watch. 3 hours to go. He left the castle and headed down a side street. He waited out a sudden chilly rain shower under a cafe awning and drank a cup of coffee. Later he passed a sign for the ghost tour of underground Edinburgh, adults only, and only conducted after full darkness had set in. It was almost time. Roby had memorized every step, every turn, every move he would have to make. To live. As he did every time, he had to hope it would be enough. Will Roby did not want to die in Edinburgh. A bit later, he passed a man who nodded at him. It was just a slight dip of the head, nothing more. Then the man was gone, and Roby turned down the doorway the man had vacated. He shut and locked it behind him and moved forward, quickening his pace. His shoes were rubber-soled. They made no sound on the stone floor. 600 feet in, he saw the door on the right side. He took it. An old monk's cloak was hung on a peg. He donned it and put the hood up. There were other things there for him, all necessary. Gloves, night vision goggles, a recorder, a Glock pistol with suppressor can attached, and a knife. He waited, checking his watch every 5 minutes. His watch was synced to the very second with someone else's. He opened another door and passed through it. He moved downward, reached a grate in the floor, lifted it, and skittered down a set of iron handrails set into the stone. He hit the floor silently, moved left, counted off his paces. Above him was Edinburgh, at least the new part. He was in underground Edinburgh now, home to several ghost and walking tours. There were the vaults under South Bridge, and parts of old Edinburgh, such as Mary King's Close, among others. He glided down the dark brick and stone passages, his powered goggles letting him see everything in crisp definition. Electric lamps on the walls were set at fairly regular intervals, but it was still very dark down here. He could almost hear the voices of the dead around him. It was part of local lore that when the plague came in the 1600s, it struck impoverished areas of the city, such as Mary King's Close, especially hard. And in response, the city walled up folks here forever to prevent the spread of the disease. Roby didn't know if that was true or not, but it wouldn't surprise him if it were. That's what civilization sometimes did to threats, real or perceived. They walled them off, us against them, survival of the fittest. You die, so I can live. He checked his watch. 10 minutes to go. He moved slower, adjusting his pace so he would arrive seconds before he was supposed to, just in case. He heard them before he saw them. There were 5, not counting the guide, the man, and the peripherals. They would be armed. They would be ready. The peripherals would think this was the perfect place for an ambush. They would be right. It was stupid for the man to come down here. It was. The carrot had to be especially big. It was. It was as big as it was total bullshit. Still, he had come because he knew no better, which made Roby wonder how dangerous the man really was. But that was not his call. He had 4 minutes to go. Chapter 2. Roby rounded one final bend. He heard the guide talking, giving the memorized spiel, and delivering it in a mysterious, ghost-like voice. Melodrama sells, thought Roby. And in fact, the uniqueness of the voice was vital to the plan tonight. There was a right-angle turn coming up. The tour was heading for it. So was Roby, just from the opposite way. The timing was so tight that there was no margin of error. Roby counted the paces. He knew the guide was doing the same. They had even practiced the length of their strides to get them perfectly choreographed. 7 seconds later, the guide, who was the same height and build as Roby, and wearing a cloak identical to his, came around the bend, a mere 5 paces ahead of his party. He held a flashlight. That was the one thing Roby could not duplicate. Both of his hands had to be free for obvious reasons. The guide turned left and disappeared into a cleft cut into the rock that led into another room with another exit. As soon as he saw this, Roby pivoted, putting his back to the group of men who would round the corner a few moments later. One hand slipped down to the recorder on his belt under the cloak and turned it on. The guide's dramatic voice boomed out, continuing the tale that he had momentarily halted to take the turn. Roby did not like having his back to anyone, but there was no other way for the plan to work. The men had lights. They would see that he was not the guide, that he was not doing the talking, that he was wearing goggles. The voice droned on. He started to walk forward. He slowed. They caught up to him. Their lights swept across his back. He heard their collective breaths, their smells, sweat, cologne, the garlic they'd had in their meals. Their last meals. Or mine, he thought, depending on how it goes. It was time. He turned. A deep knife strike took out the point man. He dropped to the floor, trying to hold in his severed organs. Roby shot the second man in the face. The sound of the suppressed round was like a hard slap. It echoed off the rock walls and mingled with the screams of the dying men. The others were reacting now, but they were not truly professionals. They preyed on the weak and the poorly skilled. Roby was neither. There were 3 of them left, but only 2 would be any trouble. Roby hurled the knife and its point ended up in the third man's chest. He dropped, with a heart split nearly in half. The man behind him fired, but Roby had already moved, using the third man as a shield. The bullet hit the rock wall. Part of it stayed in the wall. Part of it ricocheted off and found purchase in the opposite wall. The man fired a second and third time, but he missed his target because his adrenaline had spiked, blown his fine motor skills, and caused his aim to fail. He next executed a desperation spray and pray, emptying his mag. Bullets bounced off hard rock. One slug hit the point man in the head on a ricochet. It didn't kill him because he'd already bled out, and the dead could not die a second time. The fifth man had thrown himself to the hard floor, hands over his head. Roby had seen all of this. He dropped to the floor and fired one shot into the forehead of man number 4. Those were the names he had given them. Numbers. Faceless. Easier to kill that way. Man number 5 now was the only one left. 5 was the sole reason Will Roby had flown to Edinburgh today. The others were just collateral. Their deaths meaningless in the grand scheme. Number 5 rose and then backed up as Roby got to his feet. 5 had no weapon. He had seen no need to carry one. Weapons were beneath him. He was no doubt rethinking that decision. He begged. He pleaded. He would pay an unlimited amount. Then when the pistol was pointed at him, he turned to threats. What an important man he was, how powerful his friends were. What he would do to Roby, how much pain he would suffer, he and his whole family. Roby did not listen to any of it. He had heard it all before. He fired twice, right and left side of the brain. All was fatal, as it was tonight. Number 5 kissed the stone floor, and with his last breath, hurled an expletive at Roby that neither one of them heard. Roby turned and walked through the same cleft as the tour guide. Scotland had not killed him. He was thankful for this. Roby slept soundly after killing 5 men. He awoke at 6 and ate breakfast at a cafe around the corner from where he was staying. Later he walked to Waverley Station next to the Balmoral Hotel and boarded a train to London. He arrived at King's Cross Station over 4 hours later and took a cab to Heathrow. The British Airways 777 lifted off later that afternoon. With a weak headwind, the plane touched down 7 hours later at Dulles Airport. It had been cloudy and chilly in Scotland. It was hot and dry in Virginia. The sun had long ago begun to drift low into the west. Clouds had built up during the heat of the day, but there would be no storm because there was no moisture. All Mother Nature could do was look threatening. A car was waiting for him outside the airport terminal. There was no name on the placard. Black SUV. Government plates. He got in, clicked the seatbelt shut, and lifted up a copy of the Washington Post that sat on the seat. He gave the driver no instruction. He knew where to go. Traffic on the Dulles toll road was surprisingly light. Roby's phone vibrated. He looked at the screen. One word. Congratulations. He put the phone back in his jacket pocket. Congratulations was the wrong word, he believed. Thanks would be the wrong word, too. He was not sure what the right one would be for killing 5 people. Perhaps there was none. Perhaps silence would suffice. He arrived at a building off Chain Bridge Road in Northern Virginia. There would be no debriefing. No record of anything was better. If an investigation ensued, no one could discover a record that didn't exist. But if things went wrong, Roby would have no official cover. He walked to an office, not officially his, but one that he sometimes used. Even though it was late, there were people working. They did not talk to Roby. They didn't even look at him. He knew they had no idea what he did, but they also knew not to interact with him. He sat at a desk, hit some keys on the computer, sent a few emails, and stared out a window that wasn't really a window. It was merely a box of simulated sunlight, because an actual window was just a hole that others could get through. An hour later, a chubby man in a wrinkled suit with pasty skin walked in. They didn't greet each other. Chubby placed a flash drive on the desk in front of Roby. Then he pivoted and left. Roby stared down at the silver object. The next assignment was already prepared. They had been coming at an increasing clip these last few years. He pocketed the flash drive and left. This time he drove himself in an Audi that was parked in a space in the adjacent garage. When he slid into the seat, he felt comfortable. The Audi was his, had been for 4 years. He drove it through the security checkpoint. The guard did not look at him either. The invisible man in Edinburgh. Roby knew how it felt. Once he hit the public road, he shifted gears and accelerated. His phone vibrated once more. He checked the screen. Happy birthday. It didn't make him smile. It didn't make him do anything other than drop the phone on the opposite seat and punch the gas. There would be no cake and no candles. As he drove, Roby thought of the underground tunnel in Edinburgh. 4 of the dead men were bodyguards. They were hard, desperate men who had allegedly murdered at least 50 people over the last 5 years, some of them children. The 5th man, with 2 holes in his head, was Carlos Rivera, a trafficker of heroin and youngsters for prostitution. He was immensely rich and had been visiting Scotland on holiday. Roby knew, though, that Rivera actually had ostensibly been in Edinburgh to attend a high-level meeting with another criminal czar from Russia in an effort to merge their business interests. Even criminals like to globalize. Roby had been ordered to kill Rivera, but not because of his human and drug trafficking businesses. Rivera had to die because the United States had learned that he was planning a coup in Mexico with the aid of several high-ranking generals in the Mexican army. The resulting government would have been no friend of America, so this could not be allowed to happen. The meeting with the Russian crime czar had been the setup, the carrot. There was no czar, and no meeting. The offending Mexican generals were also dead, killed by men like Roby. When Roby arrived home, he walked for 2 hours through the darkened streets. He ventured down by the river and watched the headlights on the Virginia side cut through the night. A police patrol boat slid past on the calm surface of the Potomac. He stared up at the drab, moonless sky. A cake without candles. Happy birthday to me, he thought. Chapter 3. It was 3 a.m. Will Roby had been awake for 2 hours. The mission set forth on the flash drive he'd been given would cause him to travel well past Edinburgh. The target was yet another well-protected man with more money than morals. Roby had been working on the task for nearly a month. The details were numerous. The margin of error was even less than with Rivera. The preparation was arduous and had taken its toll on Roby. He could not sleep. He was also not eating very much. But he was trying to relax now. He was sitting in the small kitchen of his apartment. It was located in an affluent area with many magnificent places to live. Roby's building was not one of them. It was old, utilitarian in design, with noisy pipes, odd smells, and tacky carpet. Its occupants were diverse and hard-working, with most just starting out in life. They left early every morning to take their place at law firms, accounting practices, and investment concerns spread over the city. Some had chosen the public sector route and took the subway or bus, biked, or even walked to the large government buildings housing the likes of the FBI, the IRS, and the Federal Reserve. Roby did not know any of them, though he saw all of them from time to time. He had been briefed on all of them. They all kept to themselves, immersed in their careers, their ambitions. Roby kept to himself, too. He prepared for the next job. He sweated the details because it was the only way he could survive. He rose and stared out the window, down to the street where only one car passed by. Roby had traveled the world for a dozen years now, and everywhere he went, someone died. He could no longer remember the names of all the people whose lives he had ended. They didn't matter to him when he was killing them, and they didn't matter to him now. The man who had previously held Roby's position had operated during a particularly busy time for Roby's clandestine agency. Shane Connors had terminated nearly 30% more targets than Roby had in the same amount of time. Connors had been a good, sound mentor to the man who would replace him. After his retirement, Connors had been assigned to a desk job. Roby had had little contact with him over the last 5 years, but there were few men Roby respected more. And thinking about Connors made Roby dwell for a bit on his own retirement. A number of years off, it would eventually happen. If I survive, he thought. Roby's line of work was a young man's game. Even at 40, Roby knew he couldn't do it another dozen years. His skills would erode too much. One of his targets would be better than he was. He would die. And then his thoughts came back to Shane Connors, sitting behind his desk. Roby supposed that was death too, simply by another name. He walked to the front door, placed his eye against the peephole. Though he didn't personally know any of his neighbors, that did not mean he wasn't curious about them. He was, in fact, very curious. It wasn't hard to explain why. Their lives were normal. Roby's was not. Seeing them going about their everyday lives was his only way to stay connected to reality. He had even thought about starting to socialize with some of them, Not only would it provide good cover for him, attempting to blend in, but also it would help prepare him for the day when he would no longer do what he did now, when he might have a normal life of sorts. Then his thoughts turned, as they inevitably did, back to the upcoming mission. One more trip. One more kill. It would be difficult, but then they all were. He could very easily die, but that was also always the case. It was a strange way to spend one's life, he knew. But it was his way. Chapter 4. The Costa del Sol had lived up to its name today. Roby wore a straw-colored narrow-brim hat, a white t-shirt, a blue jacket, faded jeans and sandals. There was 3 days' worth of stubble on his tanned face. He was on holiday, or at least looked to be. Roby boarded the large, bulky ferry to cross the Strait of Gibraltar. He looked back to the mountains rising along the rugged and imposing Spanish coastline. The juxtaposition of the high rock to the blue med was captivating. He admired it for a few seconds and then turned away, forgetting the image just as quickly. He had other things occupying his mind. The high-speed ferry headed to Morocco. It pitched and swayed like a metronome as it left Tarifa Harbor on its way to Tangier. Once it gathered speed and hit the open waters, the ride smoothed out. The belly of the ferry was filled with cars, buses, and tractor trailers. The rest was crammed with passengers eating, playing video games in an arcade, and purchasing duty-free cigarettes and perfume by the carload. Roby sat in his seat and admired the view, or at least pretended to. The strait was only 9 miles wide, and the ride would take only about 40 minutes. Not a lot of time to contemplate anything. He spent it alternately gazing out at the waters of the Med and studying the other passengers. They were mostly tourists, eager to say they had been to Africa, although Roby knew that Morocco was very different from what most people probably would think of Africa to be like. He walked off the ferry in Tangier. Buses, taxis, and tour guides awaited the masses. Roby bypassed them all and left the port on foot. He entered the main streets of the town and was instantly besieged by peddlers, beggars, and shopkeepers. Children pulled on his jacket, asking for money. He pointed his gaze down and kept walking. He passed through the congested spice market. At one corner, he nearly stepped on an elderly woman who looked to have fallen asleep while holding onto a few loaves of bread for sale. This had probably been her entire life, thought Roby. This corner, and a few loaves of bread for sale. Her clothes were dirty, her skin the same. She was soft and plump, but malnourished, as was often the case. He bent down and put some coins in her hand. Her gnarled fingers closed around them. She thanked him in her language. He said, "You're welcome," in his. They both somehow understood the exchange. He walked on, increasing his pace, taking any steps he encountered two and three at a time. He passed by snake charmers, who placed exotically colored and defanged reptiles around the necks of sunburned tourists. They wouldn't take the snakes off unless €5 were placed in their hands. A nice racket if one could get it, thought Roby. His destination was a room over a restaurant promising authentic local food. It was a tourist trap, he knew. The food was generic, the beer warm, and the service indifferent. The bus guides led unsuspecting folks there and then hurried elsewhere to eat a far better meal. He headed up the stairs, unlocked the door to the room with the key he had previously been given, and locked the door behind him. He looked around. Bed, chair, window. All he needed. He put his hat on the bed, looked out the window, and eyed his watch. It was 11 a.m. local time. The flash drive had long since been destroyed. The plan was in place and the movements practiced at a mock facility back in the States that was the exact duplicate of his target. Now he simply had to wait, the hardest part of all. He sat on the bed, massaged his neck, working out kinks from the long trip by plane and boat. This time the target was no idiot like Rivera. He was a cautious man with professional assets who wouldn't spray bullets around. This one would be harder, or at least it should be. Roby had brought nothing with him from Spain because he had to pass through customs to get on the ferry. A weapon found in a bag by Spanish police would have been something more than problematic. But everything he needed would be in Tangier. He took off his jacket, lay back on the bed, and let the heat from the outside make him drowsy. He closed his eyes, knowing he would open them again in 4 hours. The sounds from the street receded as he fell asleep. When he woke, nearly 4 hours had passed, and it was the hottest part of the day. He wiped sweat from his face and went back to the window, looked out. He watched big tour buses navigate streets never built for anything so large or cumbersome. The sidewalks were full of people, both locals and visitors. He waited another hour and then left his room. On the street, he turned east and double-timed it. In a few seconds, he was lost in the hustle and bustle of the old city. He would collect what he needed and move on. All these items would be for the mission. He had traveled to 37 countries and had never purchased a single souvenir. 7 hours later, it was quite dark. Roby approached the large, stark facility from the west. Over his back was slung a hardened case and a knapsack with water, a pea jar, and provisions. He did not plan on leaving here for the next 3 days. He looked around, taking in the smells of a third world country. The air was also heavy with the threat of rain. That would not bother him. This task was an inside job. He checked his watch and heard it approach. He ducked down behind a cluster of barrels. The truck passed by him and stopped. He approached it from the rear. 3 strides later, he was under it, holding on to metal jutting out from its underside. The truck drove on and then stopped once more. There was a long, wrenching sound of metal on metal. It started up again with a jolt that nearly caused Roby to lose his grip. 50 feet later, the truck stopped once more. The doors opened. Feet touched the floor. Doors clunked shut. Footsteps headed off. The wrenching sound came again. Then hardened locks were clicked into place. There was quiet, except for the footfalls of the perimeter patrol that would be there 24/7 for at least the next 3 days. Roby timed it so he was out from under the truck and racing away just as the wrenching sound stopped. The facility technically had been cleared and put in lockdown. This was the only opportunity Roby had to get in. Mission accomplished, at least this part. He took the steps 3 at a time, the hard-sided case hitting him in the back. Next came the race against the clock. He reached the top, grabbed the girder, and did a monkey crawl, hand over hand, to the targeted spot. He swung to the left, and then the right, and then made his leap. He landed nearly silently on metal and skittered to a spot 80 feet distant in one of the darkest corners of the space. He did so with 5 seconds to spare. The lights clicked off and the alarms came on. The interior space was instantly crisscrossed with beams of energy that were invisible to the naked eye. But if anything with a pulse touched them, sirens would go off. All intruders found would be executed. It was just that sort of place. Roby turned over on his back, his face to the ceiling. 3 days, or 72 hours to go. It seemed his entire existence was one uninterrupted countdown. Chapter 5. It was time. The prayer rugs came out. Knees dropped to the ground, and all heads turned east, and then lowered to rest near the knees. Mouths opened, and the familiar chants flowed. Mecca was 2,500 nautical miles away, about 5 hours by plane. For the folks on the rugs, it was a lot closer. Prayers said, religious duties fulfilled, the rugs were rolled back up and stowed away. Allah was also put away, in the backs of his followers' minds. It was too early to eat, but it was not too early to drink. There were places in Tangier that accommodated this, Muslim teetotalers or not. The 24 men went to one such place. They did not walk along the streets. They traveled in a 4-Hummer motorcade. The Hummers were armored to American military standards and would defeat all bullets and most missile strikes. Like the buses, these vehicles seemed far too large for the narrow streets. The main man rode in the 3rd Hummer, where his front and rear were covered. The man's name was Khalid bin Talal. He was a Saudi prince, a cousin to the king. With that sole connection, he was accorded respect in almost all corners of the Muslim and Christian worlds. He did not come to Tangier very often. Tonight he was here to do business. He was scheduled to leave during the early morning hours in his private jet that cost well over $100 million, a staggering sum to virtually anyone. It was less than 1% of his net worth. The Saudis were close allies of the West in general, and the Americans specifically, at least in public. A stable flow of petroleum made for good friendships. The world moved around at speed, and men from a desert country where few things would grow could afford aircraft costing 9 figures. However, this Saudi prince was not such a friend. Talal hated the West. He hated the Americans most of all. That was a dangerous position to openly take against the world's remaining superpower. Talal was suspected in the kidnapping, torture, and murder of 4 U.S. servicemen, abducted from a club in London. Nothing could be proven, though, and the prince had suffered no consequences. He was also suspected of bankrolling 3 terrorist attacks in 2 different countries, resulting in the deaths of over 100 people. 12 of them Americans. Again, nothing could be proven, and there were no repercussions. But those actions eventually had put Talal on a list, and the payment for being on that list was about to come due with the full blessing of the Saudi leadership. He simply had become too bothersome and ambitious to let survive. The people he had come here to meet did not much like the West or the Americans either. They and Talal had a lot in common. They envisioned a world that did not have the stars and stripes leading the way. The gathering was to discuss how to make such a world happen. This caucus was a closely guarded secret. Their mistake was letting the closely guarded secret no longer remain a secret. The club was entered through a metal door with a number pad. Talal's lead guard hit the 10-digit code that was changed daily. The 6-inch-thick hydraulic-powered door clanged shut behind them. There were blast walls set up at strategic points. The interior perimeter was ringed by armed guards. This was serious security for the few people who could afford it. The prince and his group sat at a large round table in a roped-off area that was hidden behind drapes and set atop an elevated teak wood platform. The prince's eyes continually moved, sizing up the environment around him. He had survived 2 assassination attempts, one by a cousin of his and another by the French. The cousin was dead, and so was France's best contract killer. Talal trusted no one. He knew the Americans wouldn't be far behind now that their French ally had failed. His guards were vetted and loyal, and a close-knit group that allowed no outsiders in. There were no whites, blacks, or Hispanics anywhere near his inner circle. He was armed. He was a good shot. He kept his mirrored sunglasses on even indoors. No one could tell where he was looking. The lenses were also specially designed. Their magnification levels allowed him to see things his naked eye could not.
But he did not have eyes in the back of his head.
The uniformed waiter approached not with drinks, but merely with napkins. The prince brought his own glasses and liquor. Being poisoned was not on his agenda. He poured his Bombay Sapphire and added the tonic. He sipped, his gaze swiveling, his mind partly focused on the upcoming meeting. He was prepared for every contingency, except an enlarged prostate. It was an annoyance that even his wealth could not overcome. He could not have someone else piss for him. His men made sure the bathroom was empty of enemies and free of explosives, and inaccessible except for the one door. An aide wiped down the sink, commode, and stall with an antibacterial spray. Billionaire royalty do not frequent urinals. Talal went to the cleansed stall, closed the door behind him, and latched it, using a handkerchief to do so. He had discarded his robes before coming here. He wore a custom-made suit that cost 10,000 British pounds. He had 50 such suits and couldn't remember where they all were, since they were spread over as many properties around the world. He had never flown commercial, even as a young man. He had teams of servants at each of his homes. When he stayed at hotels, they were the finest, and he rented out entire floors so he would not have to endure seeing a common person when he went to his room. He was whisked everywhere, either by motorcade or helicopter. People of his wealth did not sit in traffic. His life of rarefied luxury was unimaginable, and that was fine by him, because in his mind, he was unlike other human beings. "I am better," he thought. "Far better." Yet he still had to unzip his fly to do his personal business, just like every other man, rich or poor. He studied the wall in front of him, the graffiti and filthy language written there. He finally looked away in disgust. It was the Western influence that had brought such things, of that he was convinced. In that world, women could drive cars, vote, work outside the house, and dress like whores. It was ruining the world. Even his country now said that women could vote and do other things that only men should be able to do. The king was insane, and worse, a puppet of the West. He hit the flush lever with the sole of his shoe, zipped his pants, and unlatched the stall door. While he washed his hands, he stared at his image in the mirror. A 50-year-old man looked back at him, gray in the beard and quite large in the belly. He was worth well north of $12 billion, making him the 61st richest person in the world, according to Forbes magazine. He had taken his oil money and leveraged it into many profitable operations, using his business savvy and international connections. He was sandwiched on the list between a Russian oligarch who used gangster tactics after the fall of the Soviet Union to snap up state assets for virtually nothing, and a 20-something tech king whose company had never made a dime in profit. He left the bathroom and walked back to the table with his guards organized in a hard diamond pattern around him. He had copied this tactic from the American Secret Service. His personal physician traveled with him, just like the U.S. president. Why not emulate the strongest, was his thinking. And in his mind, he was just as important as the American president. In fact, he would have liked to replace him as the de facto leader of the free world, although the world would not be nearly as free with him in charge, starting with the women. Drinks finished, they moved on to their evening meal at a restaurant that had been completely rented out so that the prince could dine in peace without the fear of strangers interrupting. After that, he changed back into his robes and returned to his jet, housed in a secure hangar back at a private jet park outside the city. The Hummers pulled past the open doors of the hangar and stopped in front of the massive jet. While most planes were painted white, this one was all black. The prince liked the color. He thought it was masculine and powerful, and possessed a tangible element of danger. Just like him. The hangar doors closed before he got out of the Hummer. There would be no targets for long-range rifle shots between open hangar doors. He walked up the steps, puffing slightly as he neared the top. The hangar doors would reopen only when the plane was ready to take off. The meeting would be held on the plane while it was on the ground. The meeting would last for 1 hour. The prince would control the meeting. He was used to controlling situations. That was about to end. Chapter 6. There were two guards at the bottom of the stairs leading to the jet. The rest of the security was in the plane, surrounding what would be the main target for any attack. The fuselage door was closed, locked. It was like a vault, a very expensive vault. But like all vaults, there were weaknesses. The prince sat at the center of the table in the main part of the cabin. The interior was entirely of his own design. The plane consisted of nearly 8,000 square feet of marble and exotic woods, oriental rugs, and exquisite paintings and sculptures by long-dead museum-quality artists that he could admire at 41,000 feet and 500 miles an hour. Talal was a man who spent his money and thereby enjoyed his wealth. He gazed around the table. There were two men here who were visitors. One was Russian, the other Palestinian. An unlikely partnership, but one that intrigued the prince. They had promised that for the right price, they could accomplish something that virtually everyone, the prince included, would have thought impossible. The prince cleared his throat. "You're sure you can do this?" His tone was full of incredulity. The Russian, a big man with a full beard and a hairless head that gave him an unbalanced, bottom-heavy appearance, nodded slowly but firmly. The prince said, "I am curious as to how this is possible, because I have been told that it is absolutely pointless even to try. The strongest chain is defeated by its weakest link." This came from the Palestinian. He was a small man, but with a fuller beard than the Russian. They were like a tugboat and a battleship, but it was clear that the small man was the leader of the partnership. "And what is the weakest link?" "One person, but that person is placed next to the one you want. We own that person." "I cannot see how that is possible," said the prince. "It is not just possible, it is fact." "But even so, access to weapons?" "The person's job will allow access to the necessary weapon."
"And how do you own such a person?"
"That detail is not important."
"It is important to me. This person must be willing to die, then. There is no other way."
The Palestinian nodded. "That condition is met."
"Why? Westerners do not do that."
"I did not say that the person is a Westerner."
"A plant?"
"Decades in the making."
"Why? Why do any of us do anything? We believe in certain things, and we must take steps to realize those beliefs."
The prince sat back. He looked intrigued. The Palestinian said, "The plans are in place, but, as you know, significant funds are required for something like this, much of it in the aftermath. Our person is secure for now, but that could change soon. There are eyes and ears everywhere. The longer we wait, the greater the chances of the mission failing before it has been given a chance to succeed."
The prince ran his fingers over the carved wood of the table as he glanced out the window. The windows were extra large because he enjoyed the views from his high perch. The subsonic round hit him squarely in the forehead, exploding his brain. He fell back against his leather seat and then slowly slid to the floor.
Gray matter, blood, bone, and tissue covered the plane's once beautiful interior. The Russian leapt up, but had no weapon. It had been confiscated at the door. The Palestinian just sat there, paralyzed. The guards reacted. One pointed to the shattered plane window. "Out there!" They rushed to the door. The two guards outside the plane had drawn their weapons and fired at the source of the fatal shot. Shots pinged around Roby's position. He aimed and fired back. The first sentry fell with a kill shot to the head. The second collapsed a few moments after that, with a bullet wedged in his heart. From his high perch, Roby pointed his rifle's muzzle at the door of the plane. He sent five shots right through the center, destroying the opening mechanism. He swiveled around and took out the cockpit window, and with it, the plane's controls. The big bird would be grounded for a while. It was fortunate for his mission that bulletproof material was too thick and heavy to carry on planes. That made it simply a $100 million vault with a very large Achilles heel. Then he was done with killing. Now came the hardest part. The exit. He tightwalked down the girder until he reached a wall on the far side of the hangar. He pushed open the window, attached his cable to the support ring he had bolted into place the night before, and rappelled down the wall. His feet touched the asphalt, and he ran due east, away from the hangar and the dead prince. He scaled a fence, dropped to the other side. He heard shouts behind him. Some beams of light broke the darkness. Shots headed his way, all way off target. He knew that could change. The car raced up. He threw his gear in the back seat, jumped in, and it drove off before his door was even shut. Roby did not look at the driver, and the driver did not look at him. The car traveled for only a few miles and entered the outskirts of Tangier before stopping. Roby slipped out, headed down an alley, walked another 500 feet, and entered a small courtyard. A blue Fiat was there. He slid into the driver's seat, snagged the keys from under the visor, and started it up. He gunned the engine and left the courtyard. 5 minutes later, he neared the center of Tangier. He drove through the city and parked the car at the port. He popped the rear hatch and pulled out a small bag packed with clothes and other essentials, including travel documents and local currency. He boarded not the high-speed ferry back to Spain, which he had taken to get here, but instead the slow ferry from Tangier to Barcelona. It took 24 hours to go from Barcelona to Tangier and 3 hours longer to go from Tangier to Barcelona. His employer had sprung for a three-person family berth rather than simply a seat. He went to this space, stowed his bag, locked his door, and lay on the bed. A few minutes later, the ferry slipped away from the dock. Roby could see the logic. No one would expect an assassin to escape via a boat that took over a full day to get to its destination. They would check the airports, the high-speed ferries, the highways, and the train stations, but not the lumbering old bathtub that would take 27 hours to go a few hundred miles up the Med. He would actually arrive 2 days from now, since it was nearly midnight. Roby had had with him a long-range surveillance cone that had allowed him to hear the conversation on the plane between the prince and the two other men. Access to weapons, decades in the making, significant funds for the aftermath. It would have to be followed up, but that was not his job. He had completed his task. He would make his report and others would now take over. He was certain that even the Saudi royal family would be relieved that one of their black sheep had been killed. Their official statement would condemn such an act of violence. They would demand a full investigation. They would posture and fume and whine. Tense diplomatic communications would be exchanged. But in private, they would toast the ones responsible for the killing. In other words, they would toast the Americans. It had been a clean operation. Roby had had the prince in his crosshairs from the moment he'd gotten out of his SUV. He could have taken him out then, but wanted to wait until the prince and his guards were on the plane. It would allow him more time to get away if the security detail were trapped inside the aircraft. He had lost sight of the prince for about half a minute right after he had entered the plane, but had reacquired him as he walked down the aisle and sat at the table. Roby had aimed for the head of Talal, even though it was a tougher shot, because of something he'd seen through his scope. When the prince had leaned forward in his chair, Roby had seen the straps underneath the man's robes. He was wearing body armor. One did not wear body armor around the head. Roby had spent 3 days and nights of his life perched high up, peeing into a jar and eating power bars, while waiting for his target in a facility that was supposedly in lockdown and totally secure. Now, the prince was dead. His plans would die with him. Will Roby closed his eyes and slept, as the ferry gently swayed on its slow ride over the calm waters of the Med. Chapter 7. This one was different. It was close to home. So close that it was home. Nearly 3 months had passed since Tangier and the death of Khalid bin Talal. The weather was cooler, the sky a little grayer. Roby had not killed anyone during that time. It was an unusually long period for him to be inactive, but he did not mind. He took walks, he read books, he ate out. He did some traveling that did not involve the death of someone. In other words, he acted normal. But then that flash drive had appeared, and Roby had had to stop being normal and pick up his gun again. The mission had come to him 2 days ago. Not much time to prepare, but the mission was a priority, the flash drive told him. And when the flash spoke, Roby acted. He sat in a chair in his living room, a cup of coffee in his hand. It was early in the morning, and he had been up for several hours. As the next mission grew closer, it had been difficult for him to sleep. It had always been that way with him. Not so much nervousness as a desire for heightened preparation. When he was awake, part of his brain was constantly refining the plan, finding errors and fixing them. He could not do that while he was asleep. During his downtime, he had adhered to his earlier plan of socializing more, and even accepted an invitation to an informal party held by one of his neighbors at the man's apartment on the third floor. Only a dozen people had attended, some of whom also lived in the building. The neighbor had introduced Roby to several of his friends. However, Roby's attention had quickly focused on one young woman. She was a recent renter here, who made the trek to the White House as early as 4 a.m. on her bike. Roby knew where she worked because he had received a briefing on her. He knew she left that early for work because he had often watched her through his peephole. She was a lot younger than Roby, lovely, intelligent, at least from what he had observed. They had made eye contact on several occasions. Roby sensed she might be as friendless as he. He also sensed that if he started talking to her, she wouldn't have minded. She had worn a short black skirt and a white blouse. Her hair was swept back into a ponytail. She had a drink in hand, and every so often she would glance in Roby's direction, smile, and then look away as she continued her conversation with another person whom Roby didn't recognize. Several times, Roby had thought about approaching her. Yet he had left the party without doing so. As he was walking out, he'd glanced back at her. She was laughing at a comment made by someone and never looked his way. It was probably better that way, he'd thought. Because really, what would have been the point? Roby rose and stared out the window. It was fall now. The leaves in the park had started to turn. The evenings were chilly. The humidity of summer was sometimes still with them, but its intense edge had measurably eroded. The current climate was not bad for a city that was built on a swamp, and still was a swamp by many people's estimation, at least the part where the professional politicians nested. Roby had done his recon in the abbreviated time allotted. The run-throughs, logistically harder in this situation, had still been performed. And he still didn't like it. But it was not his call. The location would not involve Roby stepping on a plane or train, but the target was different as well, and not in a good way. Sometimes he went after people intent on global menace, like Rivera or Talal. Or sometimes he simply went after a problem. You could take your pick of labels, but in the end, they all meant the same thing. His employer had decided who among the living and breathing would qualify as a target. And then they turned to men like Roby to end the living and breathing part. It made the world better, was the justification. Like flinging the planet's most potent army against a madman in the Middle East. Military victory was ensured from the start. What could not be wholly predicted was what came after victory. Like a morphing chaos you couldn't escape. Trapped in a trap of your own making. The agency Roby worked for had a clear policy on operatives who were caught during a mission. There would be no acknowledgement that Roby even worked for the United States. There would be no steps taken to save him. It was the opposite of the U.S. Marines' mantra. Everyone in Roby's world was left behind. Thus, on every mission, Roby had employed an exit plan known only to him, in case the operation went awry.